Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we sift through the most impactful stories, research, and insights to bring you clarity and understanding. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, your guide.
And I'm Sam Astor, ready to help unravel these stories.
Today, we're doing a comprehensive deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, September 5th, 2025.
Exactly. This isn't just headlines. We're looking deeper at the underlying currents, the long-term implications, things that, you know, really matter to you.
Our mission, as always, is to cut through that noise, connect the dots, and give you the clearest, most impactful takeaways from, well, just an incredible range of information.
We'll connect these diverse threads, trying to help you gain a more complete picture of what's happening and, importantly, why it matters.
All right, let's open up this fascinating edition of the Wall Street Journal. It's quite a rich tapestry of our world on September 5th, 2025.
Yeah, it really is, capturing everything from power dynamics in Washington, global market shifts,
to surprising insights into urban life and culture. We have a lot of ground to cover, so let's just jump right into that intricate dance of politics and finance.
Starting with the crucial pillar of our economy, the Federal Reserve.
Okay, our first major story plunges us straight into a really contentious issue, the independence of the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
The Justice Department has actually launched a criminal investigation into Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook.
Right, and the focus is on allegations that she submitted fraudulent information on mortgage applications.
What immediately jumps out to me here is the highly charged political context.
Absolutely, because this probe follows Cook's own lawsuit alleging that President Trump's attempt to fire her was unlawful.
So that timing is just, it's critical, isn't it? It casts a long shadow over the investigation itself.
It really does. Cook's lawyer, Abby Lowell, he was quick to label this a politicized investigation.
But on the other side, the Trump administration asserts it has the authority to dismiss Fed governors for cause.
And the Justice Department's court filings, interestingly, push back on Cook's defense, arguing she hasn't yet provided her side of the story.
So this isn't just a legal proceeding. It's a very public, very high-stakes power struggle playing out.
Definitely.
And the allegations themselves, they're quite specific. There are accusations from an individual named Pulte.
Right.
That Cook misled banks to secure more favorable lending terms, like lower interest rates often reserved for owner-occupied homes.
And one detail that really stands out involves a condo in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes. Cook apparently listed it as a second home in a 2021 loan agreement.
Yet she was reportedly drawing rental income from it at the same time.
Now, while the mortgage terms might not explicitly prohibit renting, they generally stipulate the property's primary use should be as a secondary residence, you know, by the owner.
It's a fine point, but potentially significant. And the rarity of felony mortgage fraud convictions makes this probe even more significant.
Yeah, how rare are they?
Well, in 2024, the U.S. Sentencing Commission reported only 38 federal offenders. Average sentence was about 18 months.
Mm.
However, a 2023 Philadelphia Fed report did find that roughly one-third of single-family home investors misrepresent their occupancy status on mortgage applications.
Mm.
So it happens, but convictions are rare.
And the fact that this probe is being coordinated by Ed Martin, who's known as a Trump loyalist and a top Justice Department official.
But that just intensifies the perception of political motivation, doesn't it?
It does. The key insight here, I think, is that this criminal investigation against a sitting Fed governor, combined with its political timing, represents a significant challenge to the perceived independence of the institution itself.
And that potentially impacts its credibility, its standing.
Exactly. Now, adding another layer to this narrative of challenged independence, President Trump has nominated Steven Marin,
who currently chairs the White House Council of Economic Advisors.
Right. He's nominated to fill a vacant seat on the Fed board. And Marin's proposal is, well, it's quite unconventional.
Extremely. He intends to take unpaid leave from his White House role rather than resigning outright.
With the intention of returning to the executive branch later.
Which would be truly unprecedented since the modern Fed was established back in the 1930s.
And what's really striking, almost ironic, is that Marin himself previously co-authored a paper explicitly criticizing this revolving door between the executive branch and the Fed.
He even proposed a four-year ban on former Fed members serving in the executive branch.
So how does he defend this now?
Well, his defense is that his proposal should be seen as a complete package. But, you know, that argument is pretty hard to reconcile with his past stance.
I'd say so. Investment manager Mark Spindle, who co-authored A History of Fed Independence, he's argued strongly that this kind of dual role would severely erode the Fed's independence.
Gives the president undue leverage over a sitting governor, potentially.
You can imagine the pressure. Democrats have also expressed intensified concerns, particularly after Mehren offered, let's say, indirect answers when questioned about the 2020 election and allegations of job data manipulation.
So this situation, alongside the Cook investigation, it really raises fundamental questions, questions about the operational independence of the Fed, especially its rate-setting committee.
And the broader balance of power between the White House and the central bank, it feels like a real test.
Definitely. The core insight here is that President Trump's nomination of Steven Mehren, with this highly unconventional plan for a dual role, directly threatens the long-standing norms of Federal Reserve independence.
And it potentially sets a very problematic precedent for future presidential influence over crucial economic institutions. Okay, shifting our focus now to international trade. The U.S. is gearing up to renegotiate the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the USMCA.
Which is its largest free trade deal.
Exactly. Public consultations are scheduled to begin within the next month. This is actually mandated by the 2020 law for a six-year review.
So this marks the official kickoff of what could be a, well, a month-long and potentially very contentious process.
Historically, President Trump has approached these trade deals pretty aggressively, right?
Absolutely. Famously denigrating NAFTA, imposing significant tariffs. Remember the 25% duties on Canada and Mexico, all to gain leverage.
Though those were later pared back for compliant goods, as I recall.
Right. But this aggressive approach, it's clearly part of a broader strategy to reshape U.S. trade relationships and assert economic influence.
We recently saw Secretary of State Marco Rubio meet with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum.
And cross-border security coordination was apparently a top agenda item.
That meeting is widely seen as a crucial prerequisite for any successful trade agreements moving forward. It sets the stage.
And Mexico's economy minister, Marcelo Ebrard, openly acknowledged the challenges ahead. He said, "I can see that the coming months, the review of the USMCA won't be easy, but we need each other to be competitive."
Which highlights that mutual dependency, despite the tough negotiations that are clearly coming.
Yeah. The key insight here, I think, is that the upcoming USMCA renegotiation signals President Trump's intent to reassert U.S. economic and political leverage.
Potentially reshaping North American supply chains and relations.
And setting the stage for a period of trade uncertainty for businesses and consumers across the continent. The impacts, both economic and political, will be profound.
Okay, now let's pivot to a sensitive domestic policy discussion. Reports emerged that Justice Department officials considered leveraging existing laws.
The ones restricting mentally ill individuals from gun ownership.
Right, to specifically target transgender individuals.
And this discussion reportedly followed that mass shooting in Minneapolis committed by a person identified as a transgender woman.
This immediately ignited, well, a significant firestorm among gun rights advocates.
The backlash was so swift, so intense, that the White House had to quickly issue assurances that no such proposals would actually move forward.
The Justice Department, in its defense, stated it is actively evaluating options to prevent the pattern of violence we have seen from individuals with specific mental health challenges and substance abuse disorders.
But they emphasized that no specific criminal justice proposals had been advanced. Clearly a politically explosive area.
The opposition came from powerful corners, too. Gun rights groups, traditionally strong supporters of President Trump, the NRA, spent millions on his campaigns, for instance.
Right.
They voiced strong condemnation. Taylor Rhodes of the National Association for Gun Rights explicitly called it insanity and warned against targeting specific groups.
And legal experts quickly weighed in too, citing the Supreme Court's stance against disarming groups based on broad labels.
Requiring instead an individualized finding of dangerousness.
Exactly. So the key insight from this discussion is that while the administration appears willing to explore controversial new approaches to gun control after specific incidents,
the powerful lobbying forces and established legal precedents, especially those protecting individual rights, can lead to immediate and strong political reversals.
It just highlights the inherent complexities and, frankly, the political sensitivities of the gun control debate in America. It's a constant tightrope walk. #tag #PAC1.3. Power and influence in tech and education.
Okay, turning our attention now to the intersection of power and industry. President Trump recently hosted a White House dinner with several big tech leaders.
Yeah, Apple's Tim Cook was there, Sam Altman from OpenAI, Mark Zuckerberg from Meta.
And during the event, these, well, titans of technology took turns praising the president's leadership on innovation, chip manufacturing, and artificial intelligence.
It definitely had the feel of one of those Trump cabinet meetings, didn't it? With tech leaders publicly thanking him for being pro-business, pro-innovation.
Apple even used the platform to pledge a staggering $600 billion in U.S. investment.
And the conversations went beyond just accolades. They touched on practical matters crucial for the tech sector. Things like securing electricity for massive data centers, addressing regulatory roadblocks.
Especially important in the burgeoning AI space, right?
Absolutely.
There were certainly some memorable moments from that dinner. President Trump notably commented to Mark Zuckerberg, "This is the beginning of your political career."
Right, after Zuckerberg seemed taken aback by a question about a speech crackdown in the UK.
Which connects to that Graham Linehan story we'll touch on later. Trump also made a pointed remark to Sundar Pichai, CEO of Alphabet,
saying, "You had a very good day yesterday following that federal judge's decision to levy relatively light penalties in the antitrust case against Google."
These moments kind of hint at the administration's, let's say, transactional relationship with the tech industry.
Yeah. The key insight here is that this White House dinner signals a strategic alignment between the tech industry and the current administration.
And this alignment could significantly influence future regulations, investments, even the global race for AI dominance with China.
Potentially shaping which companies thrive and under what conditions in the years ahead.
Now, in stark contrast to the tech industry's apparent alignment, we have news from the academic world.
Right. Northwestern University President Michael Shill has resigned,
citing challenges at the federal level.
And this comes after the university had a significant chunk of its federal research money frozen, $790 million.
Due to pressure from the Trump administration over its handling of pro-Palestinian protests on campus.
This situation really brings up critical questions about academic freedom and, you know, the extent of federal government influence over private universities.
Northwestern was an early target of the federal task force to combat anti-Semitism.
And the administration's demands were quite specific. They wanted new leadership in problematic depths, suggested receivership, called for an external audit of viewpoint diversity,
and even demanded the hiring and admission of a critical mass of diverse faculty and students. Heavy stuff.
Very. And when Harvard refused similar demands, its $2.2 billion in federal funds were frozen. This suggests a systematic approach.
A federal judge, in fact, ruled in Harvard's case that the funding freeze was illegal and violated the First Amendment,
citing that NRA v. Volo case from 2024, which prohibits coercing private parties to suppress disfavored speech.
But despite that legal victory for Harvard, Northwestern still had to lean heavily on its own university funds to maintain research.
And tragically, had to eliminate 425 jobs due to the immense financial pressure. It shows the power the federal government can wield, even if its actions are later deemed unlawful.
Yeah. The key insight is that the resignation of Northwestern's president under this federal pressure highlights the administration's willingness to use financial leverage to influence campus speech and governance.
And this sets a really concerning precedent for academic freedom and the autonomy of private universities facing political agendas.
All right, let's discuss a topic that consistently seems to erode public trust. Why lawmakers often resist banning their own stock trading.
It's a perennial issue, isn't it?
It is. Republican Representative Rod Bresnahan, who actually campaigned on banning lawmaker stock trading, is now drawing criticism himself for becoming one of the most active traders in Congress.
This situation perfectly illustrates that tension between public expectations and, well, political realities.
Bresnahan, for his part, claims an advisor handles his trades without his input. He dismissed suggestions of his direct involvement as complete and utter bullshit.
Right. He also voiced frustration with the excruciating process required to set up a blind trust.
The core arguments against such bans often revolve around not discouraging successful business people from running for office,
contrasting sharply with proponents who see it as a clear avenue for potential corruption and insider trading.
Public opinion on this, though, is overwhelmingly clear. A 2023 University of Maryland survey found a staggering 86% of Americans favor a ban.
Wow. 86%.
Yeah. Interestingly, the data shows only about a third of House lawmakers and less than half of senators traded individual stocks last year. Mutual funds are far more common and generally wouldn't be affected by these bans.
So it's not like everyone is doing it, but the perception is damaging.
Exactly. There's new bipartisan legislation, which Bresnahan himself actually supports now.
Oh, interesting.
That would mandate selling stocks within 180 days or face fines with tax deferrals for reinvesting in mutual funds. However, House Speaker Mike Johnson appears hesitant to bring it to a vote.
So the key insight here is that while there's overwhelming public and bipartisan support for curbing congressional stock trading, practical challenges and internal political resistance continue to obstruct meaningful reform.
Which just sustains that persistent challenge to public trust in government ethics and integrity.
Definitely.
Okay, shifting to corporate finances. Many large U.S. companies are projecting substantial declines in their cash tax payments.
And this is thanks to a new tax law.
Right, that accelerates or expands deductions for corporate research, interest payments, and equipment purchases.
And these changes are retroactive to President Trump's second inauguration.
So this new legislation is designed to significantly reduce corporate taxes. The projection is a $219 billion reduction through 2034.
With a substantial $88 billion impact in fiscal years 2025 and 2026 alone. That's huge.
And what's particularly noteworthy is that these business tax changes are effectively rectifying problems initially created by Republicans back in 2017.
Right. At that time, they delayed certain tax increases to meet long-run budget targets, but then failed to prevent those increases from actually taking effect in 2022.
So, in many ways, it's a legislative course correction. A fix for a previous fix, almost.
You could say that. And these savings translate into huge boosts for corporate cash flow.
We're seeing big numbers. Verizon Communications expects lowering its 2025 cash tax costs by $1.5 to $2 billion.
Lumen Technologies already erected a $400 million refund. Diamondback Energy expects $300 million in savings.
Leidos projects a $150 million cash flow boost. Republic Services, EOG Resources, $80 million, $200 million, respectively.
These are substantial figures that will definitely impact investment decisions, stock buybacks, shareholder returns.
Yeah. The key insight is that this new tax law, while providing significant immediate cash flow benefits to large U.S. corporations by accelerating deductions,
primarily corrects self-imposed policy issues from 2017.
So this move will boost corporate investments and shareholder value, but it will also inevitably fuel ongoing debates about the federal budget and the broader distribution of economic benefits. Who really benefits most? Okay, turning our gaze now to the global chessboard. French President Emmanuel Macron has announced a significant development.
What's that?
26 countries are apparently prepared to contribute to a peacekeeping mission in Ukraine.
Wow, 26. But contingent on a cessation of hostilities with Russia.
Right, exactly. This initiative is part of a broader, concerted effort to pressure Russian President Vladimir Putin to negotiate and, crucially, to secure robust security guarantees for Ukraine's future.
Which is interesting because Putin has shown little interest in negotiations so far.
True. But this initiative clearly demonstrates Europe's resolve to shape Ukraine's post-conflict security landscape.
Even in the face of that disinterest. Now, the Trump administration has indicated it's warm to the idea of some U.S. security guarantees.
Signaling a willingness to use air power, but explicitly ruling out American ground troops.
Which creates a complex dynamic. Because many European nations are looking for clearer assurances from the U.S. about backup before committing their own forces.
Macron, for his part, chose not to specify individual country contributions or deployment areas. He emphasized any troops involved would be not on the front line.
But high-level discussions have apparently already taken place with U.S. generals and NATO officials, so the planning is serious.
Undoubtedly. The ultimate effectiveness and confidence in such a multinational force will hinge on the clarity and perceived strength of President Trump's commitments, which, as you said, remain somewhat ambiguous right now.
Yeah. The key insight here is that European nations are actively pursuing this multilateral peacekeeping solution for Ukraine, reflecting a proactive approach to regional security.
But its effectiveness remains heavily dependent on the extent and clarity of U.S. security commitments, which is currently a significant variable.
Big question mark.
Okay, now to a highly controversial development. President Trump ordered the U.S. military to destroy a vessel in the Caribbean,
resulting in 11 fatalities.
The administration defended this action by claiming the drugs being smuggled posed an imminent national security threat, framing it as part of an expanded campaign against drug cartels.
This immediately raises profound questions about presidential powers and really the redefinition of imminent threat.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth explicitly likened drug cartels to al-Qaeda, stating the military's role is to defeat such imminent threats.
But a consensus among legal experts is that President Trump exceeded his authority here.
Arguing the casualties weren't engaged in anything like a direct attack on the United States and weren't afforded a trial.
This application of anti-terrorism tactics to counter-narcotics operations, it really pushes existing legal boundaries significantly.
And the details surrounding the strike are particularly stark. It was carried out without warning shots, without any attempts to detain the individuals.
Which deviates significantly from typical Coast Guard interdictions.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio even provided conflicting accounts regarding the vessel's intended destination.
And legal experts, including former Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall and law professor Jeffrey Korn, were unequivocal. They called it an extrajudicial killing.
Outside both domestic and international law, lacking a legitimate self-defense claim.
Plus, the U.S. reportedly has limited intelligence on these small drug boats from Venezuela, further complicating the justification for such a drastic response.
So the key insight is that President Trump's order to use lethal military force here, justified by this expansive redefinition of imminent national security threat,
represents a profound challenge to establish legal norms regarding the use of military power.
And this action has significant ethical and legal ramifications, potentially impacting international law and U.S. relations in the region.
Especially considering Venezuela's swift F-16 response.
Right. Okay. Shifting focus to East Asia. There's a significant and, frankly, concerning buildup of infrastructure along China's eastern coast.
New naval facilities, expanding helicopter bases.
All strongly indicating China's growing readiness for a potential conflict with Taiwan.
This infrastructure development is a tangible and strategic signal of China's intent. We're seeing reports of a new naval facility in Yuking Bay.
Featuring a mile-long pier designed for numerous vessels, including tank transports, landing craft.
And an expanding helicopter base in Fujian Province, directly across from Taiwan, strategically positioned to reach Taiwan's southwestern beaches, likely amphibious assault sites, and the critical Penghu Islands.
These aren't just defensive postures. They look like preparations for offensive capabilities.
Exactly. And it's not just explicit military installations either. Consider the Xiamenqiangan International Airport.
A civilian airport, technically, but located on Dadang Island, just 2.3 miles from Taiwan's Kinmen Archipelago.
And this airport has doubled in size through dredging, becoming a massive air cargo hub with robust connectivity, vast warehouses.
And researchers have already observed Chinese drones utilizing this airfield, highlighting its dual-use potential for military logistics in a conflict scenario.
Yeah. The key insight is that China's extensive military and dual-use infrastructure built up along its eastern coast unequivocally signals a growing readiness for a potential conflict with Taiwan.
These tangible preparations raise serious concerns about the balance of power in the Indo-Pacific.
And underscore the potential for a complex multi-point invasion strategy that would severely challenge Taiwan's defense capabilities. #2.2. Internal political and economic dynamics.
All right, let's turn to internal political dynamics, specifically in Uganda. General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, the son and presumed heir apparent of President Yoweri Museveni.
Uganda's long-serving president.
Right. He's generating considerable headlines for, well, erratic behavior and provocative social media boasts.
Joking about invading Kenya, openly boasting about torture, threatening to arrest members of parliament. It's quite a list.
This situation in Uganda is indeed deeply concerning, particularly given Uganda's strategic role as a key U.S. military partner in a frequently unstable region.
And President Museveni, now 80, has manipulated term limits to stay in power for over four decades.
Despite ironically criticizing leaders who overstay in power in his own inaugural address years ago.
Muhoozi, at 51, seems to firmly believe he's next in line. He famously posted on X, "In the name of Jesus Christ, my God, I shall be president of this country after my father."
It paints a clear picture of an entrenched dynastic approach to power.
And his social media activity is particularly alarming, taking full responsibility for beating an opponent, threatening strong actions against those who abuse his family.
Vowing to arrest fools in parliament.
Who?
While his advisor, Andrew Mwenda, tries to downplay these posts as just meant to amuse and provoke.
Right, not actual policy.
The implications for governance and human rights are undeniable. And this lack of a clear democratic transition plan beyond Museveni's Plan A, Plan B, Plan C, Plan D is Muhoozi.
Only adds to regional instability and raises significant human rights concerns.
Yeah. The key insight here is that General Muhoozi Kainerugaba's erratic behavior and public boasts against the backdrop of his father's four-decade rule creates significant uncertainty for Uganda's future.
This dynastic succession model, coupled with a disregard for democratic norms and human rights, raises serious questions about regional stability and U.S. foreign policy in East Africa.
Okay, moving to Europe's economic landscape. A recent sharp increase in yields on 30-year U.K. government bonds, or gilts, has raised concerns about the government's debt. However, officials are arguing this might not significantly worsen the overall debt problem.
Why is that?
Primarily because the government no longer relies heavily on these particular long-term bonds for financing.
Ah, so it's a nuanced point about sovereign debt management and financial strategy?
Exactly. The UK government has strategically shifted its borrowing towards shorter maturity gilts.
And this change is largely due to waning demand from pension funds, which have transitioned from defined benefit schemes to defined contribution models.
Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey clarified this, stating the 30-year rate is actually not a number that is being used for funding at all at the moment.
Which fundamentally recontextualizes the concern about those rising yields.
But despite this strategic shift, the UK's debt servicing bill remains substantial. It's projected at 8.3% of total government spending, or 3.6% of annual economic output.
And economists like Alan Monks of JP Morgan suggest this revised perspective might paint a rosier picture of public finances than the underlying reality.
The government's own self-imposed fiscal rules, initially introduced to reassure investors, don't offer much comfort due to frequent panics.
But abandoning them entirely would pose a big risk, especially after that significant bond market crash in 2022.
True. So the key insight is that the UK government's strategic shift away from long-term gilts helps mitigate the immediate impact of rising yields on its debt.
However, this adjustment is a response to broader market changes in the pension industry and kind of masks underlying fiscal vulnerabilities.
Suggesting the UK's long-term financial stability remains, well, precariously balanced.
Seems that way.
Now, Germany's Ifo Institute has recently revised its economic growth forecasts downward,
projecting only 0.2% growth this year, down from 0.3%, and 1.3% in 2026, down from 1.5%.
And this reduction is largely attributed to the noticeable impact of U.S. tariffs.
This represents a direct and palpable consequence of global trade policies on a major European economy.
Timo Wolmershauser, head of forecasts at IFO, explicitly highlighted the impact of U.S. tariffs, including that 15% tariff on most EU goods imported into the U.S. as a key factor.
And while Germany's industrial production and exports did see a temporary boost in the first quarter, as sales were maybe pulled forward to beat the tariffs,
that effect clearly reversed after April, indicating a sustained drag on the economy.
Germany's economy has been notably sluggish anyway, having barely grown since 2019, and contracting in both 2023 and 2024.
Exacerbated by spiraling energy costs and intense global competition. Looking ahead, unemployment's expected to rise slightly, inflation projected to increase to 2.6% in 2027.
This scenario underscores the broader consequences of U.S. trade policies on major European economies, and the potential for Germany to face a prolonged period of economic paralysis.
Yeah. The key insight is that U.S. tariffs are directly contributing to a noticeable deceleration in Germany's economic growth, exacerbating an already stagnant period for Europe's largest economy.
This highlights the significant ripple effects of protectionist trade policies on global trade relationships and potential prolonged economic challenges for major export-oriented nations.
Okay, let's turn to a pressing debate regarding free speech, this time in the United Kingdom. British police recently arrested comedian Graham Linehan at Heathrow Airport,
detaining him for hours over three tweets expressing disapproval of transgenderism.
And his subsequent bail condition was highly restrictive, forbidden from posting on X, formerly Twitter.
This is a truly striking example of what critics are increasingly calling speech policing in the UK.
It follows other controversial cases like Lucy Connolly's 31-month prison sentence for a social media post related to anti-immigration riots.
Elon Musk even described Britain as a two-tier country, criticizing disparate treatment of offenders. It indicates a significant divergence from the robust constitutional protections for free speech we see in the U.S.
Critics argue Britain's free speech tradition just isn't as strong. They suggest British institutions are becoming captured by noisy special interests on highly sensitive issues like transgenderism and immigration.
And many believe politicians, often perceived as lacking credibility, are particularly vulnerable to vocal, highly motivated activists, leading to the suppression of what might be considered popular speech on these topics.
This has led one columnist to provocatively describe Britain as becoming a failed state in this context. Raises serious questions about the nation's values.
It does. The key insight is that the arrest of Graham Linehan over social media posts highlights an alarming trend of speech policing in the UK, signaling a significant divergence from US free speech protections.
Raising critical questions about censorship, the role of law enforcement in monitoring online expression, and the long-term societal implications for open discourse in Britain.
Absolutely.
Now, on a completely different note, there's a fascinating counter-narrative emerging from the UK regarding religious belief.
Oh, what's that?
Evidence suggests a modest but real Christian revival in Britain, challenging the long-held assumption of rapid secularization.
That's interesting. Anglican clergy reporting new parishioners, Catholic dioceses seeing an increase in adult baptisms.
Yeah, one coastal town even celebrated 92 mass baptisms in the sea.
Wow. This really challenges the conventional wisdom about uniformly secularizing Western societies.
Joe Gilbert, a Catholic chaplaincy coordinator, notes a renewed interest in spiritual openness, particularly among younger generations.
And while some surveys still indicate a decline in overall church attendance, many sociologists believe something real is happening, that secularization may have peaked.
It mirrors evidence from the U.S. Religious Landscape Survey, which found Christianity in America has also stabilized in the 2020s after a long decline.
The article highlights an intriguing split. Rapid decline in some Christian communities and unexpectedly vibrant growth in others.
Growth particularly evident in Pentecostal churches and full-fat faith traditions.
Those that address core human questions of purpose, hope after death, forgiveness, areas where secular humanism has often struggled to provide satisfactory answers.
Exactly. The key insight is that, contrary to widespread assumptions, there is evidence of a modest but real Christian revival in Britain, particularly among younger generations and in certain vibrant faith traditions.
This challenges conventional sociological predictions of linear secularization and suggests a renewed spiritual openness as individuals seek meaning and answers to fundamental human questions.
All right, let's conclude this global section with a truly intriguing, almost surreal moment, a hot mic incident in Beijing.
What happened?
It captured Chinese President Xi Jinping, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un engaging in a casual discussion about human longevity and even immortality.
Wow, during a parade.
During a parade. This seemingly lighthearted conversation, though, underscores a profound geopolitical reality.
Which is?
The United States will likely be contending with these three strongmen for many years to come.
Right. All three leaders are securely positioned to remain in power as long as health allows, and crucially, none have established clear succession plans.
Xi and Putin are both 72, Kim is 41, and each has skillfully manipulated their respective political systems to potentially serve for life.
And on the hot mic, Putin mused about organ transplants, getting younger, perhaps even immortal.
While Xi optimistically predicted people living to 150.
Of course, the health of these leaders is among the most closely guarded secrets in the world.
Past observations have hinted at potential issues. Xi's limped in 2019, Putin's handshaking or odd posture.
Kim's well-documented health challenges, smoking, obesity, high blood pressure, family history of cardiovascular illness.
And in a telling detail from Beijing, Kim's aides were observed taking extraordinary measures to meticulously wipe his chair after his meeting with Putin.
Presumably to avoid leaving any biological clues about his health. Fascinating.
So the key insight is that this hot mic moment, while seemingly trivial, highlights the deep geopolitical reality of entrenched, long-serving authoritarian leaders who envision indefinite rule and lack clear succession plans.
Which raises the stakes for long-term international relations and global stability, forcing the world to contend with these powerful figures for the foreseeable future.
Now, adding another layer to this narrative of dynastic power, Kim Jong-un's young daughter made high-profile appearances in Beijing.
Fueling speculation, she's being groomed for a more significant role, potentially even succession.
And helping to humanize Kim's often brutal image.
This is a fascinating glimpse into how authoritarian regimes manage succession and public image. North Korea's dynastic rule is built on direct lineage.
So her presence, possibly her first overseas trip, sends a clear signal meant to normalize the idea of her as a future successor.
And she has been accompanying her father to various military and diplomatic events since 2022, which is quite unusual for a young child, signals her growing importance.
Predictably, North Korea has maintained extreme secrecy around her. No name revealed, no age, referring to her only as the beloved child.
While former NBA star Dennis Rodman claimed her name was Ju-ae back in 2013, others dispute this.
South Korea's spy agency believes she is likely Kim's second child, born 2013, and currently considers her the most probable successor.
So the key insight is that the high-profile public appearances of Kim Jong-un's young daughter in Beijing are a deliberate strategic move.
To normalize the idea of dynastic succession and soften his international image.
This development could signal a new era for North Korea's leadership, with significant implications for internal dynamics and regional stability.
Okay, let's pivot now to the world of business and innovation. Apple's Vision Pro mixed reality headset, the $3,500 one.
Right. The one many thought was too expensive for consumers had usability concerns.
Well, it's surprisingly finding its footing in narrow and deep business applications.
This is a fascinating reverse migration of technology adoption. Unlike the iPhone, which started with consumers, then moved to business.
Vision Pro is seeing enterprise-led adoption. Its high-end immersive audio and visual experiences are proving ideal for very specific industrial applications.
Like highly detailed pilot training, complex surgical support, intricate kitchen design, things like that.
Suggests the initial high price point and advanced capabilities align better with niche business needs where the ROI is clearer.
And companies are already deploying it in practical ways. Lowe's, for example, is using Vision Pro in stores to help customers visualize kitchen designs.
With ambitious plans to scale this to 400 locations.
CAE, the aerospace company, is using it to train pilots on the Bombardier Global 7500, allowing virtual co-location of crew members.
The device's spatial computing capabilities, blending digital content with the physical world or immersing users in virtual environments, are clearly proving their value in these specialized fields.
Yeah. The key insight here is that despite its high cost and initial consumer skepticism, Apple's Vision Pro is successfully finding its market in highly specialized business applications.
Driving innovation in enterprise workflows. This reverse migration suggests a future where Reality Plus devices will increasingly transform professional training, design, and operational roles across industries.
Definitely something to watch.
Okay, on the semiconductor front, Pierre Barnabé, CEO of French semiconductor materials maker Sagatec, has a cautious outlook.
He predicts chip demand from the automotive industry is unlikely to recover before the end of COM25.
Attributing this to ongoing inventory correction and broader market uncertainties?
This prolonged slump in a significant sector has led Soitec to actually shelve its annual guidance due to low visibility, shows the uncertainty.
While Soitec is somewhat insulated from direct tariffs, only about 8% of revenue from direct U.S. exports.
The company still maintains a positive long-term outlook, driven by the fact that modern vehicles are becoming increasingly sophisticated, requiring more chips.
Especially with the accelerating integration of AI, Barnabé specifically highlighted AI as the big engine for future growth.
Right. So Soitec anticipates sharply declining automotive and industrial sales in the current quarter, reflecting the downturn.
But its edge in cloud AI, Maris, is projected to see a slight rise. Illustrates a clear divergence within the semiconductor market,
where AI-driven demand is starting to offset weakness in other sectors.
The key insight here is that the automotive sector's chip demand faces a prolonged slump until late 2025, impacting suppliers like Soitec.
However, the rapidly accelerating integration of AI into vehicles and factories is poised to fundamentally reshape the semiconductor industry, with AI becoming the primary driver of long-term growth.
Moving to healthcare innovation, a wave of startups, including one called Somnair, are developing exciting new alternatives to the traditional CPAP machine for obstructive sleep apnea,
which is a widespread disorder affecting an estimated 1 billion people globally. Huge numbers.
OSA, obstructive sleep apnea, is a significant public health issue. Throat muscles relax during sleep, block the airway,
leading to snoring, daytime sleepiness, increased risk of serious conditions like stroke.
And while CPAP therapy is the gold standard, many patients just can't tolerate it. Poor compliance, ongoing health issues.
That's where these new innovations are so crucial. Somnair, for example, secured $4.3 million in seed financing for its non-surgical neurostimulation treatment.
What does that involve?
It's an Invisalign-like oral device. It activates specific motor neurons, increasing muscle tone in the throat, preventing the airway collapse.
A proof of concept study has already shown promising results, restoring airflow in 25 patients.
Somnair is aiming for FDA authorization in 2027, market entry by 2028. Estimated cost $5,000 to $8,000, expected to be covered by insurance.
Could really be a game changer for millions.
Absolutely. The key insight is that new neurostimulation treatments for OSA, like Somnair's device, represent a significant breakthrough.
Could revolutionize care for millions struggling with CPAP intolerance, improve compliance, enhance quality of life,
and potentially reduce the substantial economic burden of chronic sleep disorders on the healthcare system.
Finally, let's turn our attention to the financial markets. Stocks recently rallied, pushing the S&P 500 to a new record high,
largely driven by growing hopes for interest rate cuts.
This optimism was fueled by recent economic data, specifically a lower-than-expected ADP private employment report, only 54,000 jobs added, coupled with slightly higher jobless claims.
Several factors were at play here. Beyond rate cut hopes, sustained enthusiasm around AI also provided a significant boost to tech stocks.
We saw Western Digital climb about 5%, Amazon up 4.3%, partly due to its satellite internet venture.
Meanwhile, oil prices declined, and gold futures, while retreating from recent record highs, still remained robustly near $3,600 a troy ounce, shows underlying strength.
Interestingly, while U.S. markets soared, Chinese stocks experienced a pullback after a red-hot rally,
sparking concerns among analysts that Chinese regulators might intervene to curb excess market moves and speculative trading.
And separately, NASDAQ is actively tightening its China listing rules due to ongoing pump-and-dump worries.
These are all interconnected threads in the global financial tapestry.
Yeah. The key insight is that the recent stock market rally, pushing the S&P 500 to a new record, is primarily driven by investor optimism for rate cuts and sustained AI enthusiasm.
However, this bullish sentiment exists alongside global market complexities, including concerns about speculative trading in China and evolving international listing regulations. Highlights the multifaceted factors influencing today's investment landscape. #3.2. Corporate strategies and global headwinds.
Okay, staying with global market dynamics, NASDAQ is taking a firm stance, tightening its rules for small Chinese stocks.
A direct response to those pump and dump worries and growing criticism about potential fraud and market manipulation.
The new proposed rules are quite stringent, require China-based companies to raise at least $25 million in an IPO, maintain a minimum float of $15 million,
and faster delistings for non-compliance. NASDAQ identified emerging patterns associated with potential pump and dump schemes.
They noted nearly 70% of their referrals to the SEC and FINRA since August 2022 involved Chinese companies.
Despite these firms representing less than 10% of total listings, a huge disparity.
This regulatory tightening aligns with the Trump administration's broader decoupling stance, which has already seen dozens of Chinese companies delisting from U.S. exchanges since 2019.
Virtue Financial explicitly criticized NASDAQ's previous too lax minimum listing standards, arguing they allow dubious companies to gain unwarranted legitimacy.
So the key insight here is that NASDAQ's tightening of listing rules for small Chinese stocks marks a significant move to combat fraud and protect investors.
This action deepens the ongoing U.S.-China financial decoupling, making U.S. capital markets less accessible for some Chinese firms and potentially intensifying geopolitical tensions.
In another clear example of global headwinds impacting corporate strategy, Porsche AG is set to exit Germany's DAX index.
This follows a period where its share price was negatively impacted by U.S. tariffs and significant challenges in the crucial Chinese automotive market, led to a series of guidance cuts.
This is a direct and rather painful illustration of how trade policy can have significant, tangible effects on major global corporations and, in turn, on key stock market indexes.
Porsche's departure from the DAX signifies the inherent fragility of global supply chains and the vulnerability of international luxury brands to protectionist policies.
Underscores how these political and economic decisions can ripple through major economies, directly influencing market benchmarks and corporate valuations.
Yeah. The key insight is that Porsche AG's departure from Germany's DAX index directly demonstrates the significant negative impact of U.S. tariffs and challenges in the Chinese market on global luxury brands.
This event underscores the fragility of international supply chains and how protectionist policies can directly influence corporate valuations and even national stock market composition.
And speaking of Chinese markets, Chinese stocks recently experienced that pullback after the red-hot rally,
sparking concerns among analysts that regulators might intervene to curb excess market moves and speculative trading.
The recent rally saw equities in China and Hong Kong swoon, led by a sharp correction in semiconductor and tech hardware stocks, which had seen the largest gains.
The Shanghai Composite Index had hit a 10-year high in August, indicating the intensity of that prior speculative fervor.
Beijing, however, prefers a slow and orderly bull market, and its regulators have a history of intervening short-selling limits, quant trading curbs,
showcasing a tight control over market dynamics that contrasts sharply with Western market principles.
Companies like Cambricon Technologies, China's NVIDIA, offer a perfect example. Wild roller coaster ride, record highs, then correcting sharply after a regulatory warning.
This valuation discipline exercised by Beijing creates a unique and often unpredictable environment for investors considering Chinese equities. Policy can often override market forces.
Absolutely. The key insight is that Chinese stocks experienced a sharp pullback after a speculative rally, prompting concerns about regulatory intervention.
This highlights Beijing's preference for a controlled market and its willingness to enforce valuation discipline, creating a unique investment environment where policy interventions significantly influence market performance.
Okay, let's turn to a critical domestic issue. California Governor Gavin Newsom has proposed an $18 billion plan to shore up the state's utilities against escalating wildfire liabilities.
But investors and analysts are largely skeptical, believing the plan is insufficient for a durable, long-term solution.
It's a truly dire situation. The California Wildfire Fund, set up in 2019 after PG&E's bankruptcy,
had only $13 billion in net assets as of June 30th. There's real concern it could be quickly exhausted if Southern California Edison is found liable for the recent Eaton fire,
which alone is estimated at $15 billion in insured losses, $131 billion total economic losses for the LA fires. And crucially, the fund lacks a replenishment mechanism. It's finite.
Newsom's proposal aims to raise $18 billion by 2045, half from utilities, half from customer bills, but widely considered inadequate.
Because a single catastrophic fire could, as we've seen, easily cause damage far exceeding that amount.
And California's inverse condemnation doctrine further complicates things, holding utilities strictly liable for property damage regardless of fault. Huge exposure.
Yeah. The key insight is that Governor Newsom's $18 billion plan is widely deemed insufficient by experts, primarily due to the lack of a replenishment mechanism and the strict inverse condemnation doctrine,
leaving utilities, investors, and residents highly vulnerable to mounting financial and operational challenges, with significant implications for the state's energy infrastructure.
Now, 6 months after President Trump's latest tariffs were imposed, businesses like Thompson Traders importing copper bathtubs from India, kitchen sinks from Turkey, are struggling profoundly,
grappling with immense pricing uncertainty due to constantly changing levies and painfully slow negotiations with major retailers.
This is a very direct illustration of how trade policy impacts small and medium-sized businesses. Trump's 50% tariff on copper, steep levies on Indian goods.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell recently stated the effects of tariffs on consumer prices are now clearly visible.
Businesses are caught in a bind, hesitant to raise prices, fearing consumer backlash, while retailers are reluctant to absorb higher costs, creates a standoff.
Thompson Traders provides a stark example. Requested a modest 4-5% increase from Lowe's for Turkish sinks due to a 10% tariff. Took months to get even partial agreement.
They've considered drastic measures, like raising a $450 copper sink to $800, likely making it unmarketable. Even halted shipments from India entirely due to uncertainty.
So the key insight is that 6 months into new tariff regimes, small and medium businesses face severe pricing uncertainty and operational challenges.
This tariff-induced instability creates cascading negative effects across supply chains, threatening business viability, impacting consumer prices, and the broader economy.
Okay, in a notable reversal of a long-standing corporate trend, there's a surge in corporate breakups.
Companies increasingly splitting themselves into smaller entities, often to appease frustrated investors and unlock hidden value.
This represents a reevaluation of previous consolidation strategies. Many companies realizing over-optimism of synergies or believing in economies of scale that weren't there.
Corporate breakups are inherently costly, time-consuming, often require executives to admit past strategic errors. Yet, they're becoming a preferred strategy.
We see prominent examples. Kraft Heinz facing pressure, Warren Buffett reportedly opposing a breakup vote.
Activist investor Elliott Management took a stake in PepsiCo, arguing the drinks business suffered from food unit distractions.
Honeywell International already split into three, Callaway Golf separating from Topgolf Entertainment Group.
Yeah. The key insight is that a growing wave of corporate breakups signals a fundamental reevaluation of past consolidation strategies. driven by investor demand for focused operations.
A realization that anticipated synergies often fail to materialize. This trend aims to unlock shareholder value by allowing distinct business units to operate independently.
Okay, in a move reflecting a broader trend, Paramount is requiring employees back to the office 5 days a week.
Part of a larger strategy to cut over $2 billion in costs, offering severance to those unwilling to comply.
This decision is a clear signal of a widespread return-to-office push gaining momentum post-pandemic.
Other companies, like Starbucks, have offered buyouts for non-compliance with increased in-office mandates, like a four-day work week.
Motivations are multifaceted. Cost savings, operational efficiency, perceived benefits in collaboration, fostering corporate culture, boosting productivity.
Right. The key insight is that Paramount's five-day in-office mandate exemplifies a widespread corporate push to reverse pandemic-era remote work trends and cut costs.
This strategy highlights a growing tension between cost savings and employee flexibility, with potential impacts on morale, retention, and the future of corporate culture.
Turning to the investment world, T. Rowe Price's stock jumped 6% after Goldman Sachs agreed to invest up to $1 billion and partner on new funds.
Funds providing 401k and other retirement accounts with unprecedented access to private market investments.
This agreement aligns perfectly with the Trump administration's broader initiative to make it easier for everyday Americans to invest in less liquid assets, private equity, private credit, real estate.
The market is immense, about $12 trillion in U.S. 401k. This partnership allows Goldman to tap into T. Rowe Price's vast 401k client base, Strategic Alliance.
These new target date funds, combining public and private investments, will compete directly with offerings from BlackRock, Vanguard, Blackstone.
While these private market investments offer potential for higher octane returns, they also introduce new risks for individual savers, reduced liquidity, potentially higher fees.
Yeah. The key insight is that the Goldman Sachs T. Rowe Price partnership represents a significant shift in the retirement investment landscape.
Aligned with federal policy, it promises potential higher returns, but also introduces new risks, like illiquidity and fees, fundamentally reshaping how everyday Americans can invest.
In a noticeable cultural shift, European companies are increasingly adopting U.S.-style policing of workplace relationships,
leading to high-profile executive ousters, marking a departure from Europe's traditionally more laissez-faire attitude.
This convergence is influenced by evolving U.S. cultural norms and the ongoing impact of the hashtag MeToo movement.
While European privacy laws historically offered more cover, companies are now actively intervening when conflicts of interest arise or ethical boundaries are crossed, especially in hierarchical relationships.
Examples like Nestlé CEO Laurent Freixe's dismissal after an anonymous tip about a relationship with a subordinate. Similar policy changes at BP, ITV, Gelp, Energer.
The growing expectation for executive accountability and stricter corporate governance is now global. U.S. examples. Former CEOs of McDonald's, Intel, Kohl's, Norfolk Southern, losing jobs over similar incidents.
So the key insight is that European companies are rapidly adopting stricter U.S.-style policies for policing workplace relationships.
This cultural convergence signals a global trend towards increased executive accountability and more rigorous corporate governance, particularly concerning conflicts of interest.
In a significant strategic pivot, Gap CEO is pushing the company beyond apparel into cosmetics.
Old Navy rolling out new beauty products this fall. Gap stores adding fragrances next year.
Represents a substantial change for Gap, which has grappled with slumping demand in its core business. A clear effort to attract new customers.
Capitalizing on a broader retail trend, luxury brands to mall chains entering the lucrative beauty market, like Kohl's partnership with Sephora, could be a lifeline.
CEO Richard Dixon, who took over in August 2023, is credited with making the Gap brand cool again, already seeing sales growth.
This diversification into cosmetics, while offering growth potential, also comes with risks in a highly competitive market. Could impact brand identity.
Definitely. The key insight is that Gap's strategic pivot into cosmetics marks a significant effort to diversify beyond its struggling core apparel business.
This high-stakes move reflects a broader retail trend and, while offering growth, carries substantial risks for brand identity and market positioning.
On a lighter note, remarkable success story. Garage Beer, backed by NFL stars Travis and Jason Kelce,
achieved an impressive $200 million valuation in its first institutional fundraising round. Noteworthy given concerns about beer's popularity.
Truly remarkable against market trends. Projected revenue, $60-70 million this year, up from less than $20 million in 2024.
The Kelsey brothers are hands-on investors, not just endorsers. Combined with savvy social media, events, connecting with younger drinkers, millennials, Gen Z.
The broader beer market faces headwinds. Health-conscious consumers, competition from canned cocktails, THC drinks, even GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic reportedly cutting alcohol sales.
Constellation Brands even cut its fiscal year outlook due to weakness. Garage Beer's success with low-carb, low-calorie marketing emulates Michelob Ultra strategy.
So the key insight is Garage Beer's rapid rise, powered by celebrity appeal and targeted marketing, defies broader declines in beer consumption.
Highlights evolving consumer preferences where authenticity, connection, specific health attributes, amplified by cultural figures, can drive significant growth even in challenging markets.
Finally, record EV sales boosted the U.S. auto market in August. EVs and plug-in hybrids surged to 11% market share.
Largely driven by consumers rushing to use those $7,500 federal tax credits expiring September 30th.
The surge, however, is widely anticipated to wane significantly once the credits expire.
In preparation, major automakers like GM, VW, Rivian are already planning production cuts, even layoffs.
Even EV leader Tesla saw U.S. sales slide 6.7% in August, suggesting the broader market without incentives is feeling the pinch.
We're seeing tangible actions. GM cutting a shift at an EV plant, starting new Bolt EV production with one shift instead of two.
VW slowing ID.4 SUV production, furloughing 160 workers. Rivian laid off over 200 employees ahead of a cheaper SUV launch.
Interestingly, prices remain relatively steady despite Trump's tariffs, which have shamed billions from automakers' bottom lines and disrupted compliance credit sales for EV-only companies.
Right. The key insight is that the record surge in U.S. EV sales in August was largely an artificial boost driven by expiring federal tax credits, signaling an impending market contraction.
This short-term demand distortion is already prompting production cuts and layoffs, highlighting the fragile balance between policy incentives, consumer demand, and the financial viability of the EV market, further complicated by tariffs.
Okay, let's transition now to the world of arts and entertainment, starting with a review of the Stratford Festival 2025 in Canada.
This year's lineup featured a unique motorcycle-centric Macbeth, a traditional The Winter's Tale, and an energetic revival of Annie.
Always intriguing to see how classics are reinterpreted. The motorcycle-centric Macbeth featured Tom McCamus as a weather-beaten Macbeth, Lucy Peacock as Lady Macbeth.
Despite some minor inconsistencies, the overall biker gang concept was widely praised as clever and fresh, a modern lens on a tragedy.
In stark contrast, Antonio Simolino's The Winter's Tale was lauded as one of the finest Shakespeare stagings benefiting from a deep cast, traditional yet compelling.
And then Annie emerged as the season's biggest success, thanks to Donna Feuer's dynamic direction and choreography.
Harper Ray Ash shining as Annie, strong support from Dan Chamroy as Daddy Warmucks, Laura Condal as a vicious Miss Hannigan.
Also served as an unintentional yet fitting tribute to the recently passed composer Charles Strauss.
Another adaptation, Anne of Green Gables, also featured a spunky redheaded orphan, but some modernizing elements in the second act. Neon green hair, same-sex romance modestly diminished its appeal for some viewers.
Yeah. The key insight is Stratford 2025 showcased diverse theatrical approaches, from radical reinterpretation to traditional excellence.
With Annie emerging as the breakout success, highlights the enduring appeal of classic stories, both reimagined and faithfully executed.
Moving on, the Telluride Film Festival 2025 review showcased films prominently featuring famed show business personalities dealing with emotional crises.
Fascinating how filmmakers explore the human experience through the lens of celebrity and historical figures.
Ethan Hawke delivered a dazzling performance as Lorenz Hart in Richard Linklater's Blue Moon, depicting a stressed night in 1943 as Oklahoma opened.
Linklater also brought Nouvelle Vague, an homage to Jean-Luc Godard.
On the other hand, Scott Cooper's Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, with Jeremy Allen White as a depressed Bruce Springsteen writing Nebraska, got criticized for clunky writing and cheesy directorial flourishes.
Noah Baumbach's Jay Kelly featured George Clooney playing a version of himself navigating family and stardom, with Adam Sandler getting Oscar buzz.
Morgan Neville's documentary Man on the Run found Paul McCartney recovering from the Beatles' breakup via Love and Work.
Chloe Zhao's Hamnet, starring Paul Mescal as a Shakespeare, Jesse Buckley, labeled Oscar bait, but noted for intellectual anachronism.
Other releases: Yorgos Lanthimos's extremely dark comedy, Bugonia, Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, visually stunning but dead inside.
So the key insight from Telluride is this trend of exploring the human condition through celebrated figures, often delving into crises and history.
The diverse critical reception underscores the challenge of blending historical accuracy, artistic interpretation, and audience resonance.
And on the small screen, HBO's crime thriller Task from Mare of Easttown creator Brad Inglesby getting rave reviews.
Starring Mark Ruffalo as a former Catholic priest turned FBI agent hunting robbers.
Truly immersive, set in a gritty Pennsylvania of tragically fractured ne'er-do-wells, fentanyl trafficking biker gangs, and correctional facilities, sets a powerful tone.
Ruffalo's character, Tom Brandis, recalled to thwart a crew robbing drug houses run by the Dark Hearts Syndicate.
Critics praising the artful peeling of the narrative onion, bittersweet revelations, drawing comparisons to Richard Price, Dickens for character depth, intricate plotting.
Delves deeply into crime, redemption, complex human relationships in this gritty, realistic setting, solidifying its rep as one of the year's best crime thrillers.
Powerful performances from Tom Pelfrey, Jamie McShane, Sam Keeley add to the depth and intensity. Compelling watch. #tech#tech#tech 4.2, sports, business, and strategy.
All right, let's transition to sports, culture, economics. A humorous column predicting the Baltimore Ravens win the Super Bowl.
But more importantly, highlighting the NFL's immense cultural and economic power.
The author admits being routinely incorrect on predictions, but their analysis of NFL market dominance is spot on.
The league's incredible might, attributed to unparalleled TV ratings, its status as the last thing Americans do as a group, besides maybe ridiculing celebrities.
NFL flexing its muscle. Noise about an 18th game, two Netflix games on Christmas, voicing NFL Network on ESPN.
The column humorously laments needing every streaming service, besides Hallmark, to watch the season. Joking, a baby game for childbirth is next.
This relentless schedule creep and aggressive expansion underscores the NFL's unmatched cultural and economic dominance, shaping how we consume sports.
Yeah. The key insight is the NFL continues asserting unparalleled dominance through strategic schedule expansion and aggressive media deals.
Fundamentally reshaping American entertainment consumption and solidifying its position as a uniquely unifying yet increasingly fragmented collective experience.
Speaking of NFL dominance, an expose on the financial hack that built the Eagles into the NFL's super team.
The defending champs maintained a roster stacked with expensive talent by exploiting a loophole, deferring hundreds of millions in salary cap costs using void years.
Fascinating dive into the strategic accounting and creative financial maneuvers in a salary-capped league.
Strategy involves adding dummy void years at the end of contracts, spreading hefty signing bonus costs over many years.
Reducing the current year's cap hit, lessening the relative cost as the cap typically rises annually. Clever.
Scale is remarkable. Eagles have $380 million in deferred cap costs, more than double any other team.
Example, QB Jalen Hurts' $51 million annual contract has a cap charge under $22 million this season due to minimum-based salary, bonus spread via void years.
High stakes, risky strategy requires an owner like Jeffrey Lurie willing to shell out large amounts of cash up front.
So the key insight is the Eagles leveraged void years to defer hundreds of millions, allowing them to build and sustain a super team.
This creative accounting, requiring substantial upfront cash, represents a high-risk, high-reward approach to circumventing cap limits and maintaining dominance. #tech#tech#tech 4.3. Curious urban phenomena and personal stories.
Let's turn to a unique urban phenomenon, Boston's Allston Christmas.
The unofficial holiday in early September when thousands of college students dump unwanted furniture on sidewalks as leases turn over.
Right.
Creates a giant treasure hunt.
Driven by Boston's unique real estate cycle, most leases begin September 1st. Paradise for scavengers, but hazards too, bed bugs, moldy fridges, broken items.
The problem is worsening for the city. Trash pickup tonnage up nearly 30% between 2015 and 2023. Massive logistical challenge.
Countless stories illustrate this. Peyush Saini, a BC master's student, furnished his apartment this way. Janice Cheng found an IKEA patio chair.
Aaron Scott and Chris Durante found a curtain rod, Nintendo 64, plant stand, red sneakers, even climbed into a dumpster for a rug. True veterans.
So ingrained that Harpoon Brewery sells an Allston Xmas beer, carolers sing adapted classics about moving trucks, bedbugs.
Yeah. The key insight is Boston's Allston Christmas highlights a unique urban phenomena driven by student moves, transforming trash into treasure.
Underscores consumerism, waste management challenges, and surprising community resourcefulness creates a distinctive cultural moment.
Moving to a remarkable personal story, actor Dean Winters, known for Oz and Mayhem in Allstate ads,
recounts a life genuinely marked by accidents, near-death experiences, truly living up to his on-screen persona.
striking how his real-life mayhem almost eerily prepared him for his most famous role.
At 9, fell collecting golf balls, tore his spleen, had it removed. Then in 2009, due to missed vaccination, septic shock.
Clinically dead for 4 minutes and 58 seconds. Harrowing. Weeks in intensive care, extensive rehab.
Incredible story of survival. In a twist, his mayhem role came exactly a year to the day after his near-death experience.
Undergone 21 surgeries, partial amputations of fingers, toes, all stemming from missed injections related to earlier issues.
Openly discusses his career, current roles, unique hobbies, rooftop garden, DJing, opera with House and Country, testament to overcoming adversity.
Absolutely. The key insight is Dean Winter's life story is a powerful testament to resilience, marked by real-life mayhem, paralleling his iconic role.
His journey highlights unexpected twists of fate and the profound impact of adversity in shaping character and career. Hashtag, tag, 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 4.4, the world of real estate.
All right, let's delve into the fascinating world of real estate, starting with a classic renovation story. Lori Gibson, a veterinarian,
bought a 4-bedroom lake house near the Oregon coast for a relaxing getaway. Initial $80,000 furniture budget spiraled into a 3-year, $1 million renovation.
Quintessential tale of renovation creep. Gibson initially loved the house as it was, thought she just needed a sofa.
Persuaded by designers, the Weedmans, to undertake extensive changes, opening up the main living space for lake views, replacing portholes with modern windows, removing wood paneling.
Creating a dedicated work-from-home space fundamentally transformed the home's layout and aesthetic.
Designers paid meticulous attention, specified lower countertops for Gibson, 4'10", replaced mahogany with quartz, swapped a large triangular fireplace for a see-through spatial divider.
Significant addition built from a covered outside area, retaining the roof but raising the floor, adding skylights, created bright, functional new space.
So the key insight is Lori Gibson's journey vividly illustrates how design influence and pursuing the perfect space can dramatically expand vision and budget.
Reveals the psychological and financial complexities behind extensive home overhauls, where initial intentions often give way to ambitious redesigns.
Moving to luxury enclaves. Beaumar, a discreet Denver suburb, consistently one of the region's most expensive.
Allure not driven by mega mansions, but ample outdoor space, exclusive lake activities, mountain views.
Highlights what drives value beyond square footage. Typical lots 7 times larger than new Denver builds.
Private 100-acre Bowles Lake offers town-only recreation club sailing, swimming lessons, fostering exclusive community.
Young families pay $2 million for homes, often needing millions more in renovations to access this lifestyle.
Developed in 1950s by Lloyd King, King Super's founder. Unique zoning limits house height to preserve views.
Amenities funded by Beaumar owners. $22,500 initiation, $2,700 annual fee. COVID surge demand for its outdoor activities led to record sales.
Median single-family home price $2.3 million in 2024, significantly higher than Denver Metro's $650,000. Limited supply, maybe a dozen of 300 homes trade annually.
So the key insight is Beaumar derives its high value not from mansions, but its unique blend of space, exclusive amenities, preserved views.
Creates high demand, sustains values. Illustrates how aspirational lifestyle and community exclusivity drive luxury markets.
Now, Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi have turned real estate into a high-stakes hobby.
Bought and sold over 30 houses since mid-2000s, generating estimated $190 million in profits, turning house flipping into a massive venture.
While their business manager claims actual profits are much more modest after costs, the sheer volume and scale are undeniable.
They consistently target larger, more expensive homes, achieve nearly 80% return on the bungalow, sold to Heath Ledger, over 70% on a Montecito property, flipped to Scooter Braun.
One greatest percentage return, remodeling a Beverly Hills estate, selling for $35 million after paying $15.995 million.
High-stakes hobby offers window into financial strategies, design philosophies of successful luxury flipping, showcases keen eye, financial capacity for large-scale renovations.
Though they've also had rare losses, like a 9% hit on 2 Beverly West condos, risks exist even in luxury.
Right. The key insight is DeGeneres de Rossi transformed luxury flipping into a highly successful venture, blending design passion with astute financial strategy.
Consistent high-volume transactions highlight potential for substantial returns, driven by renovation and timing, though not without risk.
On New York's Billionaires Row, early buyers at 220 Central Park South, Andrew and Lois Arrow, listing their unit for $87.5 million.
Significantly more than the $52 million they paid in 2020.
Unit located in the priciest condominium building in the country, renowned for attracting hedge funders, entertainers, Ken Griffin's 238 mammal record purchase, Sting, Dan Ock's 188 mammal pail.
Lois Zarrow, drawn to location Central Park Broadway, expansive 6,000 square foot, four bed unit, grand living room park views, formal dining, den burgundy lacquer walls, retro diner kitchen.
Two private balconies. Remarkable ability to command astronomical prices, even as neighboring towers cut asking prices.
Enduring value attributed to prime location, unparalleled exclusivity, a spoke design, high-end amenities, private dining, athletic club, basketball court, golf simulator.
So the key insight, 220 Central Park South defies broader market trends, commanding astronomical prices, generating immense returns.
Enduring value from irreplaceable combo of location, exclusivity, design, amenities, premier trophy asset.
Heading south to Florida. Waterfront Coral Gables home sold for $34 million to attorney Anthony Lopez and former Real Housewife Nicole Martin.
Interestingly, a significant 28% discount from his original $47 million asking price.
Transaction illustrates even in ultra-luxury, significant discounts can occur, market dynamics, extended listing periods.
Impressive one-acre estate, 225-foot Biscayne Bay frontage, in exclusive gated Gables estates. Buyers plan extensive year-long renovation for primary residence.
Anthony Lopez, from humble beginnings, shared lifelong dream of a bay house, adds personal narrative. Couple owns other investment properties, recently sold another for $40.
Key insight. Even an ultra-luxury Coral Gables 28% discount highlights how market dynamics lead to price adjustments.
Underscores enduring allure of waterfront, prestigious communities driving high-value transactions, especially with renovation vision.
Finally, Mitzi Perdue, Perdue Chicken Heiress, daughter of Sheraton Hotel's co-founder, listing family's historic 104-acre Knollwood Estate in Dublin, New Hampshire for $15 million.
Significant listing, asking price far more than any home sale in the area to date.
Circa 1900 Georgian house. 13 beds, ballroom. Mitzi spent childhood summers there, steeped in history. No longer used after sister's passing.
Knollwood, built by former Treasury Sec Franklin McVeigh, bought by Mitzi's father for $10 in 1953.
Retains original features. Hardwood floors, call bells for servants. Includes
buzzard. Luxury market in Cheshire County typically tops $4, but remote work draws more high-end buyers to secluded areas. New dynamic for unique properties.
Key insight. Mitzi Perdue's listing of historic Knollwood for $15 underscores value of legacy, history, and luxury real estate.
Ambitious price tests impact of remote work trend bringing high-end buyers to rural luxury markets. Reveals appetite for unique estates.
And speaking of grand estates, late Colts owner Jim Irsay's sprawling 35,000 square foot lakefront compound on Lake Maxinkuckee, Indiana, listing for $19.9 million.
Potential new state record. Extraordinary property. Upscale European-inspired main residence, plus separate entertainment complex.
Complex features. Four-lane bowling alley, indoor shooting range, arcade, club-style bar, private resort, basically.
Unique touch. Underground tunnel connects main house to guest house and entertainment complex. Privacy, seamless access.
You say his main residence in Carmel already found buyer for 12M, shows portfolio value. Current state record $14.05 in 2022. This could surpass it.
This compound style living, bespoke amenities, reveals desired lifestyle, personal legacy of famous owner, influences market appeal, valuation.
All right, shifting now to opinion and societal discourse. We have a powerful and frankly alarming piece from Susan Monterez, the former CDC director.
Right. She writes about being fired after just 29 days by HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Her insistence on rigorous scientific review of vaccine recommendations, rather than what she calls blanket approval for his handpicked immunization committee, was the stated reason.
This piece raises critical concerns about the politicization of public health and what Monterez describes as a deliberate erosion of scientific integrity within the CDC.
She details what she perceives as a deliberate effort to weaken America's public health system and vaccine protections.
And to underscore the urgency of rebuilding public trust, she points to that recent tragic gunman attack on CDC headquarters, killing Officer David Rose,
which she directly attributes to vaccine distrust.
Monterez alleges Kennedy personally called her a liar in response to her claims.
Kennedy, for his part, justified his actions by describing a crisis of chronic disease, saying, "We are the sickest country. That's why we have to fire people at CDC. They did not do their job."
And the new immunization committee, filled with individuals who've openly expressed anti-vaccine rhetoric, is set to meet later this month, amplifies her concerns.
Yeah. The key insight here is that former CDC Director Menares' account highlights a severe politicization of public health under RFK Jr.
Threatening the scientific integrity of the CDC, eroding public trust in vaccine recommendations.
This deliberate weakening carries immense potential consequences for national health and the resurgence of preventable diseases.
Adding to this discussion are two critiques: RFK Jr.'s dangerous designs for public health and RFK Jr.'s goat rodeo.
These allege Kennedy is pursuing his own independent agenda rather than President Trump's vision, accusing him of waging a war against science and the well-being of the American people.
What's striking is the claim Kennedy stands virtually alone among Trump's cabinet in pursuing such a distinct independent agenda.
While others, like Rubio on foreign aid or Rollins on food stamps, are described as implementing Trump's goals.
Kennedy is depicted as perusing lists of his trial lawyer friends for influential HHS positions. Senator Sanders is cited criticizing Trump's initial poor leadership during COVID for exacerbating the crisis.
The core argument in these articles, irrespective of personal views on health issues, strip away how one feels about food dyes or processed food, COVID boosters or failed experts, and you are still left with a mess.
Raises questions about policy coherence, public perception. How long will Trump tolerate this exercise in political self-harm from someone he gave a top job?
Right. The key insight is critics allege RFK Jr. is pursuing an independent anti-science agenda, undermining public health, deviating from the president's vision.
This internal dissent challenges policy coherence, raises questions about political self-harm, and the long-term impact on health and safety, especially post-pandemic. #5.2, science, education, and environment.
Okay, let's move to environmental discourse. An opinion piece titled Reef Madness, A Baseless Coral Panic
provocatively argues media headlines about the Great Barrier Reef suffering worst coral decline on record are misleading. Asserts the reef is mostly healthy, shown remarkable recovery.
The author, Bjorn Lomborg, directly challenges the narrative. Contends while the reef declined until 2012, it then rebounded spectacularly, reaching its fourth highest coral cover since tracking began in 1986.
Lomborg controversially suggests some scientists stopped publishing reef-wide averages because it didn't further the climate change narrative, implying selective presentation.
He also points out the difficulty comparing current state to a pristine natural state due to limited pre-1986 data. Argues the reef naturally fluctuates, and despite recent localized declines, overall state is still great.
Challenges the perception of irreversible devastation. Raises questions about how environmental issues are framed, interpreted.
Yeah. The key insight is this piece argues media reports on the reef's decline are misleading, asserting large recovery.
This controversial perspective highlights challenges interpreting complex scientific data and how different narratives shape discourse and policy on climate change and resilience.
Next, the editorial Harvard's Pyrrhic Legal Victory reports on Harvard's legal win against the Trump administration's illegal cancellation of $2.2 billion in grants.
But the editorial board deems it Pyrrhic, suggesting Trump remains willing to use government power to punish the university.
Highlights a critical conflict between government authority and academic freedom. A federal judge ruled the administration illegally leveraged funds to control hiring, admissions, curriculum, violating the First Amendment.
Cited NRA v. Villo, 2024, on suppressing disfavored speech. Administration demands were direct. New leadership, audit of viewpoint diversity, critical mass of diverse faculty students, threatened receivership, lean on assets.
When Harvard refused, administration froze $2.2 billion. Editorial frames this as part of a multi-front war, banning foreign students, threatening tax-exempt status patents.
Consequently, Harvard used endowment funds for research, eliminated 425 jobs due to severe financial pressure.
So the key insight is Harvard's legal win is Pyrrhic, as the administration seems intent on continuing brass-knuckle tactics.
Highlights critical conflict between government authority, academic freedom, raises serious questions about higher ed's autonomy, ability to withstand political pressure.
Turning to education itself, an opinion piece by two generations of married professors argues grade inflation is a collective action problem.
Individual professors can't solve it alone. Requires coordinated, campus-wide efforts led by wise administration leadership.
Delves into a real systemic issue. Individual instructors grading rigorously face collapsing enrollments, poor evaluations, endless appeals.
They contend administrators often lack will to address it due to short-term financial imperative of retaining students, tuition revenue often trumping academic integrity.
Authors propose solutions. abolish student teaching evaluations, implement peer faculty class visits, impose caps on high grades, like University of Austin claims, merit awards for adherence,
warning students of failure risk, reinstituting difficult general exams, provocatively suggest AI might finally compel tougher grading to distinguish students from chatbot users.
Right. The key insight is grade inflation is a systemic collective action problem. Professors powerless alone without administrative leadership.
Driven by financial incentives, student pressure, impacts educational quality, degree credibility. Rise of AI may force reevaluation of grading practices. #5.3. Policy debates and international relations.
Finally, in our opinion section, the wrong way to help farmers. Sharply critiques EPA's proposed renewable fuel quotas.
Argues their wrong way to help farmers lead to higher costs for refiners and consumers.
Core proposal. Quotas for corn ethanol exceed safe blending limits, forcing refiners to buy costly credits.
Agency also raising quotas for advanced biofuels, biomass diesel, often from soybean oil, while cutting credit values for imported biofuel.
Explicitly designed to support domestic producers, like soybean farmers, but author argues creates significant unintended consequences.
Analysis for American fuel and petrochemical manufacturers estimated EPA rule imposes $70 billion compliance costs on refiners next year, twice 2023.
Critics contend it increases gas prices, could boomerang by forcing more imports, contradicting domestic support goal.
So the key insight, EPA quotas, intended to help farmers, criticized for creating significant regulatory burdens, compliance costs for refiners.
Projected to lead to higher gas prices, risk counterintuitively increasing biofuel imports, highlights complex, unintended consequences of industrial policy.
And in a compelling letter to the editor on U.S.-China relations, argument made, China won't get addicted to America's chips.
Asserts Beijing's strategy prioritizes indigenous and controllable tech for complete self-reliance from the West.
Letter argues against widespread chip sales to China, contending it liquidates U.S. leverage, turns scarcity into stockpiles for Beijing.
Highlights Chinese Communist Party doctrine prioritizes self-reliance, reinforced via state gatekeeping licensing, cybersecurity, procurement rules favoring domestic.
Cites H20 episode. After Washington licensed sales, Beijing immediately pivoted to prioritizing domestic alternatives, demonstrates commitment.
While critics acknowledge contraband ships will leak, Letter argues export controls bite, raising China's costs, stretching timelines, capping scale by constraining critical choke points.
Like training class accelerators, HBM, EDA tools, lithography equipment.
Yeah. The key insight is China's unwavering strategy for tech self-reliance means it won't get addicted, actively prioritizing indigenous innovation.
Perspective argues U.S. export controls, while not leak-proof, are effective in raising China's costs, capping scale, preserving U.S. leverage in the high-stakes global tech race. #OutCharlesDare.
Well, this deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, September 5th, 2025, has offered us an extraordinary and comprehensive look at our world.
It really has. We've navigated high-stakes power plays in Washington, examined dynamic shifts in global economies,
and explored that vibrant, often surprising tapestry of human experience and innovation. It's abundantly clear the world is moving at an incredible pace.
And understanding these complex currents is more vital than ever for you to stay truly well-informed.
Indeed. What powerfully stands out to me today is that pervasive, undeniable theme of adaptation threading through every story we've covered.
Absolutely. Whether it's businesses adapting to disruptive tariffs, political systems grappling with new leadership forms and challenged independence,
or individuals and institutions adapting to rapid technological and profound societal changes, adaptation is the constant.
It's a powerful reminder that the future isn't some fixed destination, but a continuous, dynamic process of becoming, shaped by deliberate action and unforeseen forces.
So for you, the listener, this raises an important question. In a world defined by such rapid and profound change, where do you see the most significant opportunities for adaptation?
And what areas of these evolving landscapes will you choose to explore further as you navigate your own informed path?
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and keep exploring.